I'm going to begin today by reading just a verse and a half, actually, out of Genesis chapter 4 that I just want you to keep in the back of your mind as we go through today's lesson. And in particular, the thing I want you to focus on is the question that's asked in these verses. This is, of course, the context of Cain and Abel. And Moses writes, "And it came about when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel his brother, and he killed him. And then the Lord said to Cain, 'Where's Abel your brother?' He said, 'I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?'" My plan was to finish Galatians chapter 6 today. I called Wendell at some point in the week and I said, "Well, we're going to be making it through five verses. So we'll finish Galatians next week." I've titled today's lesson, "Practical Applications of Christian Liberty." We've been talking about Christian liberty in this class. And when you get to the fifth and sixth chapter of Galatians, Paul begins to move into a very practical part of the book, and that's what he's talking about here, is how we apply in our daily lives the things that he's taught us about our liberty in Christ. This final chapter of Paul's epistle covers a number of very practical matters pertaining to Christian living in the context of the liberty to which Christ has called us. Galatians chapter 6 can be divided into three sections. The first section is the one we're going to look at today. It deals with how Christians should and should not behave toward one another in the assembly that we call the church. And Paul begins to deal with this in the first five chapters of Galatians chapter 6, and this will be our focus today. Members of the body of Christ, the church, have responsibilities to one another. And when dissensions occur, there are ways that these disputes should be handled. We'll be looking at that. Paul's going to lay out the way conflicts should be handled in the church and by whom. Then in chapter 6, verses 6 through 10, we'll be looking at these next week. Paul is going to touch on the practical side of walking in the Spirit versus walking by the flesh. To make his point, he's going to use an agricultural analogy, the principle of sowing and reaping. Finally, in the verses 11 through 18, Paul is going to discuss the essence of the faith to which the Galatians have been called. So let's look today at Galatians 6. I'm actually going to begin reading with the last verse of Galatians chapter 5. So we'll be reading 5:26 through 6:5. Paul says, "Let us not become boastful, challenging one another, envying one another. Brethren, if anyone is caught in a trespass, you who are spiritual, restore that one in a spirit of gentleness, each one looking to yourself, so that you too will not be tempted. Bear one another's burdens and thereby fulfill the law of Christ. For if anyone thinks he's something when he's nothing, he deceives himself. But each one must examine his own work, and then he'll have reason for boasting in regard to himself alone and not in regard to another. For each one will bear his own load." We're talking here about Christian relationships within the church, how Christians should and should not behave toward one another. Bible says we are to love one another. This is really, when we look here in this part of Galatians, what we're looking at is the New Testament's answer to that question that was raised back in Genesis 4. Am I my brother's keeper? Paul's answer is resoundingly, indeed, you are. We're to love one another and be concerned about the general welfare of our brothers and sisters in Christ. If you look at the Greek text of Galatians chapter 6, you'll notice that the first word, verse 1, and the last word in verse 18, except for that word amen, which is the closing term, the same word begins the chapter that ends the chapter. It's the word adelphoi. It's the Greek word that means brothers. Referring to this word, Bishop Lightfoot, in his book, the St. Paul's Epistle to the Galatians, he quotes an old Latin commentary when he says, "A whole argument lies hidden under this one word." The context that we're to consider here is the context of Christian liberty. I think John Stott may have actually coined a term. He uses the term in his description of this section of Galatians, one anotherness. I've never heard that before. I think this may be the only time this word has ever appeared. But he uses this term, one anotherness, to sum up Paul's exhortation to the Galatian Christians in this first paragraph. This is what John Stott says. He says, "Those who walk by the Spirit are led into harmonious relationships with one another. Indeed, this reciprocal one another is the word that gives cohesion to the paragraph. There's to be no provoking of one another, no envy of one another, but rather we are to bear one another's burdens. And this active one anotherness is an inevitable expression of Christian brotherhood." In John Bunyan's famous book, The Pilgrim's Progress, which was published in 1678, Bunyan presents in his book an allegory in which the main character, whose name is Christian, goes on a journey from the city of destruction, which is a place that's symbolic of the world, to the celestial city, which is symbolic of heaven. And along the way, he encounters distractions and temptations like the ones we all face in our lives, and it's not long before it becomes very evident that his journey is going to be a difficult one. In fact, it's going to be a struggle. The only way Christian can bypass the temptations and gain the goal is to do what Paul is encouraging the Galatian Christians to do, and that is to walk by the Spirit and not by the flesh. Now, in chapter 5, Paul listed some of the sins that characterize walking by the flesh, and he also listed some of the virtues that result from walking by the Spirit. And here in chapter 6, what he's going to look at will be walking by the Spirit in the context of our relationships with other believers, and he's going to focus here on four objectives. The first one is the objective of restoration, restoring a brother who's fallen victim to one of these temptations or distractions that has derailed the train. He'll speak of burden bearing, assisting one another through difficult times, of sharing, specifically sharing the blessings that God has given us with those who teach and serve us, and more generally with anyone who's in need. And finally, he's going to focus on the idea of doing good things generally to all men, but especially to the brotherhood. That would be the believers in the church that Christ has formed. What I want to do is look back one verse to that last verse of chapter 5, and I want to take a look at that in the context of what Christians should not do to one another, how we should not treat one another. Paul says there, "Let us not become boastful, challenging one another, and envying one another." Paul's already told the Galatians that we're not to allow pride to cause us to be boastful. We're not allowed to envy the lifestyle of another person. It seems that in this verse, we see a good example of what we call conceit. Conceit is an attitude that unfortunately represents our perspective on ourselves, and it affects the way we treat other people. Paul says here, "Do not become boastful." The word that he uses is an interesting Greek word. It's kenodoxis, and it's a compound word made up of actually two Greek words, kenos, which means a vessel that's empty. Think of an empty glass, just a vessel that's empty, and doxa, which means opinion or judgment or view. So in this particular word, the meaning of kenodoxis is to be proud, but without a good reason. It's pride with no basis for justification for being proud. It's translated in some versions of our Bibles as vainglory. I guess in a modern sense, we might use the term empty suit. My paraphrase here would be of that verse, "Don't be an empty suit," where in spiritual terms, an empty suit is a hypocrite. It's someone who is focused on appearances without substance. Such were the Judaizers. A conceited person, and I know we've all known some, will always treat others with condescension. And the result will always be the same. Condescension and conceit poisons relationships, and it certainly poisons relationships within the church. I would go so far as to say that a conceited person cannot display genuine love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, or gentleness, which are the very virtues that Paul said come from walking in the Spirit. A conceited person promotes his own interests, and he could care less about the interests of others. And if we allow ourselves to fall into this, if we allow ourselves to become conceited, one of two things is going to happen. Either we're going to provoke others, or we're going to envy others. Provoking means to challenge somebody to a contest. Now, if you think about that, normally you don't challenge someone to a contest if you think they're going to beat you. So just think back. When was the last time you picked a fight with someone you thought was going to put you on your back in the street? There's a presumption of superiority when we provoke somebody. Bullies only pick fights. They think they can win. When we provoke someone, it's designed to enable the proud person to demonstrate his supposed superiority over a lesser rival. Paul says, don't do this. Now, the other possibility is that the conceited person may envy others. The Greek word for envy is virtually impossible to pronounce. I wrote it up here. It's kind of down on the bottom on the left. It's spelled P-H-T-H-O-N-E-O. Now, let me just tell you a simple fact. If you're from Oklahoma, you can't pronounce a word that begins with P-H-T-H. It won't work. I tried this all week long. I even went into a special program I have that will pronounce Greek words for you, and that didn't help as well. So what's important here is not how you say the word. What's important is what it means. To envy someone is to express jealousy toward another person. So both provocation and jealousy are products of the old sin nature. They don't characterize the indwelling Spirit of God. So how should we treat each other? I'm actually going to save verse 1 for later today. We'll talk about it at the end of the lesson. So the time being, I want to direct our attention to verses 2 through 5. We'll come back to verse 1 in just a moment. Verse 2 begins by telling us to bear one another's burdens, and in so doing, to fulfill the word of Christ. Paul uses the word burden there, and it means a heavy weight or a stone that someone has to carry for a long distance. So this particular word for burden is a very serious, heavy thing that has to be carried, and it is something that pretty much exceeds the ability of a man to do this. Something you really can't do by yourself. Sometime in our lives, each one of us is going to have a burden like this to bear. I know what you're thinking, and certainly we can and we should turn to the Lord and lay that burden on Him. This is what Peter tells us to do in his first epistle in chapter 5, verse 7. It's also what Jesus tells us to do in Matthew chapter 11. If you look at Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 and following, listen to what Jesus says about burdens. He says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light." This is the same thing that David said in Psalm 55:22, when he said, "Cast your burden upon the Lord, and He'll sustain you. He'll never allow the righteous to be shaken." But guess what? There's a high likelihood that God will choose to answer that prayer for help through another Christian. The idea that God meets the needs of people supernaturally is certainly true in the sense that He's in control of all the circumstances that surround your problem. But the likelihood is very high that you may be the earthly vessel that He uses to meet the needs of your friend. And we see this consistently in this Sunday school class. I see it every week. Paul had an experience in his life that I think demonstrates how this works itself out in practice. When he was in Macedonia, his work brought him to the point of near collapse. He was exhausted and he was depressed. The text of 2 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul describes a situation like this. He says, "Our flesh had no rest, and we were afflicted on every side." Then he goes on to describe more about his circumstances. He says, "Conflicts without, fears within." I think we can all identify with this. But listen to what he says in the next verse. He says, "But God, who comforts the distressed and the depressed, comforted us by the coming of Titus. God answered Paul's prayer. He answered Paul's prayer by sending a friend, another believer, to stand by his side and help Paul bear the burdens that his ministry had put upon him. And God answered his prayer, I guess you could say supernaturally, but he did it in a very practical way. He did it through a friend. So Paul just tells us up front, he says, look, bear one another's burdens. This is what you're supposed to do. If you think that keeping every problem to yourself and trusting God silently is sound biblical doctrine, I'm going to suggest to you that it's more stoic in nature than it is Christian. Cast your burdens upon the Lord, but look around you for the answer to your prayer, because it's probably going to be someone you know who is God's instrument to help you bear the burden that you just prayed about. Of course, when we bear one another's burdens, when we involve ourselves in this way in their lives, in a very small way, we're following the example that Christ gave us on the cross. He's the one who bore the ultimate burden. So once again, we begin to see here this Pauline expectation that when we have a relationship with God, it's going to express itself through the way we deal and treat other people. And this is going to be an important theme, not just in the rest of Galatians, but if we go to James, which I'm leaning toward doing after we finish this study, that's going to be important to understanding the theology of the book of James. Paul then follows this exhortation to help one another in our problems, to bear one another's burdens, by saying when we do this, we're fulfilling the law of Christ. The law of Christ essentially is the same as the commandment to love one's neighbor that we've already seen back in chapter 5, verse 14. Jesus is quoted in John's Gospel as saying, "This is my commandment, that you love one another in the same way that I've loved you." He goes on to explain in Matthew chapter 22 that the whole law, in fact, the law, the prophets, and the writings, the entire Old Testament, is comprehended in the idea of loving God and then directing that love outward toward others. There's probably no theologian who did a better job of joining these concepts together, relating our trust in God with our relationship with the people within the church, than Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer often referred to Jesus as the man for others. It's an appropriate title because everything Jesus did was for others. And because of this, Bonhoeffer could not envision the church and the world as anything but existing for others. He said in one of his prison letters, "The church is the church only when it exists for others. The church must share in the ordinary problems of human life." In another one of his prison letters, Bonhoeffer wrote, "We've received God's blessings in happiness and in suffering. We can do nothing but pass along this blessing. Indeed, we must be a blessing wherever we go." It is, in fact, our inability to love God completely and our inability to love others as we love ourselves that is the ultimate proof of our depravity. These two failures are the essence of transgression and the evidence that we are lawbreakers. For if love of God and love of our neighbor sums up the law, if we fail in these two things, we've broken every detail of the law and every commandment that was ever given. In contrast, it's these very things, these two things, that God allowed Jesus to do in his person. Jesus fulfilled these two things perfectly. And in so doing, he fulfilled the law, even going so far as to pay the penalty for those of us who are lawbreakers. So Paul asks us to reflect or direct our love of God toward each other. Now let's look at verse 3. Verse 3 says, "For if anyone thinks he's something when he's nothing, he's deceiving himself." This is what's called a gnomic saying. That's a new word for you. Gnomic is the Greek idea of sharing an opinion. A gnomic saying is an opinion. This was probably a popular opinion that these Galatians would have known. Right after we got married, Linda and I decided to come up with two, we called them mottos, but they're really gnomic sayings or opinions, that would be something we thought two would be two things we could remember. So we have two mottos that kind of fall into this category. The first one is to each his own. And the second one is, you get what you pay for. When Paul says, if anyone thinks he's something when he's nothing, he deceives himself. He may be referring back to chapter 5, verse 26, that first verse we looked at, where he described the conceited man as one who boasts without a reason. Here he's equating vainglory with self-deception. He says, if you have this idea of yourself, that you really are important, well, that's a good example of self-deception. When we come to verses 4 and 5, we need to read those in tandem. They really stand together. But each one must examine his own work, and then he'll have reason for boasting in regard to himself alone and not in regard to another, for each one will bear his own load. In verse 4, Paul's stressing personal responsibility and self-examination. Many of the Greek schools in Paul's day stressed self-examination as a way of ensuring the student was being responsible in all areas of his life. They encouraged the students to ask questions like, wherein have I transgressed? What have I done? What duty may I have left unfulfilled? A Christian's self-examination must be up against the law of Christ because he's our example. This is not a foreign idea at all. It's exactly what we're instructed to do in 1 Corinthians before taking the Lord's Supper. God says, examine yourselves. It's an important thing. In verse 5, when you first look at that verse, it kind of looks like Paul's contradicting himself. Verse 2 says, carry each other's burdens. Verse 5 says, carry your own burdens. If you look at this in the Greek text, you'll find that two different words are used. In verse 2, it's this word baros that we talked about earlier. It refers to a heavy object that needs to be carried over a long distance, something that's very difficult or impossible for one person to do alone. But in verse 5, he uses a different word that means knapsack or backpack. This is a burden that Christ lays on his disciples in Matthew 11:30 when he says, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. When Christ says that in those verses, he's referring to this second kind of burden, this backpack. It's the burden of the Pharisees, if you think about it, the Judaizers, that's truly burdensome. It's the law of Moses that wears down a man. And I want you to notice the antithesis between Paul and these Judaizers who have come up from Jerusalem. Paul is preaching a message that frees the Galatians of a great burden, the Mosaic Law. While the Judaizers, far from sharing in burden-bearing, they're not there to stand beside the new, weaker Christians and help them bear their burdens and the difficulties of life. They're there to add an unbearable burden to their lives, a burden that not even the Judaizers have been able to bear themselves. If you want to think of this visually, verse 2 depicts a burden that's too much for a man to bear. In this case, we need to step alongside our brothers and bear this burden as a friend. But in verse 5, the burden can be pictured as a hiker carrying a small backpack or a knapsack that contains only the base essentials that are required for the hike. This is a burden no one can share with us. If we look again at John Stott, he succinctly sums up the meaning of this verse. This is what he says. We're to bear one another's burdens, which are too heavy for a man to bear alone. But there's one burden which we cannot share. Indeed, do not need to share, because it's a pack light enough for every man to carry for himself. That's me. Let me read this again, because I think John Stott's really onto something here. He says, we're to bear one another's burdens, which are too heavy for a man to bear alone. But there's one burden which we cannot share. Indeed, we do not need to share, because it's a pack light enough for every man to carry himself. What that pack is our responsibility to God on the day of judgment, on the day that you stand before the judgment seat of Christ. Stott says, I cannot carry your burden, you cannot carry mine. He recognizes, of course, that Christ bore the heavy burden for us, and that judgment to a Christian doesn't mean the same thing as it means to an unbeliever. But even believers have an appointment to give an account to the Lord for the stewardship of the responsibilities that we've been given. As a transition back to verse 1, I think it's fair to say that to bear one another's burdens, to fulfill the law, and to love our neighbors are used by Paul more or less synonymously. Verse 1 gives us a practical example of how we're to exercise love when a Christian brother falls into sin. Paul gives us instructions on several levels. We see here how we're to relate to a Christian who's fallen into sin, and we're instructed in a very difficult matter, which has come in our day to be called church discipline. When Linda and I were considering coming to Grace Bible Church, we attended here for about 6 months, and then we began discussing the possibility of joining the church. And so I went up to Chris Howell, and I said, "Chris, what's going to change if Linda and I join the church?" And Chris said, "Well, the main difference is if you join, we can kick you out." I thought, well, that's a really good reason to join. We did join. Chris was kidding, of course, and we haven't been kicked out yet. Let's look at chapter 6, verse 1. "Brethren, even if anyone is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, each one looking to yourself, that you not become tempted." The point of this verse is not to kick people out. The point of this verse is to play an important role in restoring people, particularly a fellow believer who's deliberately and overtly fallen into sin. He points out one who is caught in a trespass. That word is prolambano in Greek. It means to be taken by surprise. We might say something like to be caught red-handed. The point of this is an offense that's in question here, about which there's no doubt. This is not a matter of speculation. Probably the best biblical example is John 8 of the woman caught in adultery. The text says there, "in the very act." Now, I've always thought that was interesting, that if she was caught in the very act, we never hear about the man. I have no idea what happened to him. He's not mentioned. But I think the point here of prolambano is we're not to go around accusing people of anything based on neighborhood gossip or rumor. Now, we need to be discerning in matters like this. This is why Paul says, "You who are spiritual, restore such a one." And in that context, "you who are spiritual" does not mean "you who are self-righteous." When I was in college, for about a year I was a youth director at a little church in Jones, Oklahoma. Now, if you don't know where that is, don't worry about it. Jones is a little town with one traffic signal, one high school, and one Baptist church. It was called the First Baptist Church, which I guess is accurate. I always wondered why they didn't call it the Only Baptist Church, because it was the only Baptist church in town. I was hired there as a youth director. They paid me $50 a week, which I thought was a fortune at the time. It made a big difference in our little monthly budget, I can assure you. There were really some nice people in that church. And I'm going to tell you a story, and I don't want you to take the story and think that it applies 100% to everyone in the church. But a very interesting thing happened there in the Only Baptist Church in Jones, Oklahoma. There were a couple of things that church suffered from, as a lot of churches do and a lot of us do. And those two things were legalism and self-righteousness, two things that always go hand in hand. After church, the first Sunday, the pastor's wife, whose name was June, drove us around town. Now, June was also the pianist at the church. And I was thinking about this. If you've ever heard Willie Nelson's sister play the piano, that's what the piano sounded like at the First Baptist Church of Jones, Oklahoma. But she took us on a tour. It was the grand tour of town, all six blocks. And I guess you could also call it a tour of all the sinners' houses in Jones. By the end of the afternoon, we knew who in town was a liar. We knew who cheated on their income taxes. We knew who cussed a lot. We still laugh about one particular thing she said as she was driving around. She turned down a little side road and pointed to a little white frame house. And I promise you, verbatim, this is what she said. I'll forego the accent. "I wouldn't go so far as to say she's a prostitute, but she ain't above drinking a little." Now, this poor woman, I never met her. She may have been salt of the earth. And, you know, the problem could be something as simple as she went to the First Methodist Church instead of the First Baptist Church. I don't know. I never found out. But whatever the case may have been, this is not what verse 1 of chapter 6 of Galatians is about. What's in view in verse 1 here is a blatant disobedience by a believer of a clearly stated moral principle. Now, I know Matthew 7:1 says, "Judge not that you be not judged." I hear this quoted a lot, usually by people who are quite antagonistic toward Christians, as though any moral stand that we might take is a violation of this thou shalt not judge principle. Usually you hear it applied to whatever the media's moral issue du jour may be on any given day. And in fairness, I think I can say that what June did that day, pointing out all the sinners in Jones, Oklahoma, violated Matthew 7, verse 1. But taking an issue on a clearly designated scriptural sin that's outlined for us verbatim in Scripture is not a matter of judging, it's a matter of good judgment. There's a big difference. So if an intervention becomes necessary, what are we supposed to do? Well, most importantly, we need to keep the goal in mind. The goal is that of restoration. The word that is used for restoration in this verse is used of skillful men. It's used in one context of men who repair fishing nets, which required a great deal of attention to detail. It also appears in Greek medical literature to describe a physician who sets broken bones. That's something that takes great skill and something you wouldn't want just anybody to attempt. By the way, if I ever break a bone and you're around, please drive me to the hospital. Don't try to fix it yourself. I want a professional, someone who's skilled, to do something like that. With this in mind, who's to perform this ministry? Spiritual restoration is not something that's supposed to be done by just anybody. Paul says it's to be done by you who are spiritual. This means only someone who's led by the Spirit of God to do this ministry. But here's the interesting thing about it. We're all called to do it. He doesn't say the elders should do it, or the pastor should do it, or some particular church staff member should do it. He says you who are spiritual should do it. We're all called to do this, and if there's something in our lives that prevents us from meeting that qualification, then we should take this calling, because you're called in this way. You should take that calling as an incentive to address whatever problem is hindering you from meeting that responsibility. By God's indwelling Spirit and His grace and His empowerment, we must become spiritual and we must produce the fruit of a gentle nature, because that is the mindset in which this is to take place. Well, what about a method? You don't restore somebody by beating them to death with guilt. Correction should be done, the text says, in a spirit of gentleness, which is one of the 9 virtues that Paul has listed for us back in the previous chapter. We're to restore him or her with a disposition of meekness. This is how it's stated in the King James Bible. Luther, in his commentary on Galatians, described it like this. He said, "Run to him, reaching out your hand, raise him up again, comfort him with sweet words, and embrace him with motherly arms." Now, this is not the nature of language you normally expect to hear from Luther. He's been described as a reformer who was a bull in a china closet. But here he's focusing on the gentle nature in which this type of ministry should be performed. And it's language that is certainly attested by Paul himself. It's interesting that Paul tells the Galatians what to do, but he doesn't tell them how to do it. But there's a passage over in Matthew chapter 18 that may give us some of the wisdom of Jesus with regard to matters such as this. If you look in chapter 18 of Matthew, beginning with verse 15, listen to what Jesus says. "If your brother sins, go and show him his fault in private. If he listens to you, you've won your brother. But if he doesn't listen to you, take one or two more with you, so that by the mouth of 2 or 3 witnesses, every fact may be confirmed. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. This gives us some wisdom about how we should approach a situation like this. First, someone who is close to the person, who is led by the Holy Spirit, should go to the person who is the offender in private. Personal matters are not free game for public scrutiny unless the offense is public. Now, in the case of Galatians 2, where Paul had a dispute with Peter, Peter's offense was something that was public and it affected the entire church. So Paul rebuked him publicly for that reason. But when Jesus describes how you restore a brother, he says you need to go to that person in private. I think what Paul did by going publicly is the exception and not the rule. We should try to deal with these things private. And I might add that after we've dealt with it, it should stay private. It may be as simple as having a gentle conversation between two friends. Second thing Jesus says is, if he doesn't listen, then you should go back again, this time with a couple of other friends. This is not necessarily the time when you call the elders or the pastor. Maybe it is. This is not a ministry that belongs to the elders. This is a ministry that belongs to every Christian. If this fails, then Jesus says, take the matter to the church. And at this point, you do need to involve the elders or the pastor. The church, as we use the term today, was not yet formed when Jesus said these words. Dr. Ryrie believes that this is one of two forward-looking passages in the New Testament where Jesus does, in fact, look forward to the New Testament church. And that may well be true. I don't know that it's absolutely necessary because the word ecclesia or church is a term that means generally an assembly of some sort. It could refer to a synagogue. It could refer to the New Testament church. It might refer to what we call today a small group. The point is that the matter must be resolved at this point, or fellowship must be withdrawn and the matter left in the hands of the Lord. But there's no room here for self-righteousness. Paul warns us of this. He says, consider yourself. When you go to perform this ministry, when you're going to have this conversation, consider yourself, lest you be tempted to fall into the same sin. He's telling us that we need to go with a recognition that this could be us by the grace of God. And consider that as you do this. It's a delicate ministry that should only be entered into by a person with a humble spirit. It should be performed in gentleness and with all a thorough knowledge of the fact that we are all susceptible, perhaps even to the same sin from which we're trying to restore our brother. So that takes us through the first item here in chapter 6, which is how we should behave for and against one another, what we should and should not do. I think if you look at this and you really think about what Paul's saying, he doesn't specify people in a position of authority do something. Tell you the truth, I think in a lot of cases that's the worst possible thing you could do, would be to bring in the pastor or an elder. You know who has relationships with this person, who is their friend. And I guess the thing I would want to stress about this verse more than anything else to you is I think this is something that we're all called to do. We could, at a moment's notice, find ourselves in a situation where, lo and behold, we're the best person to conduct this ministry. There is a point where you want to bring in the elders, not necessarily in the beginning. Does that make sense? Wendell, would you close us today in prayer?